Law Focus Podcast, bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Welcome to Law Focus, the show with a staunch focus on the law. My name is Basil Shirinda, and I am going to be your guardian of the law for the evening. Right at the heart of Bramfontein, I'm bringing you the best of legal arguments straight to your ear. This is your point of legal information, and this evening we're going to be discussing debt counseling. We'll be speaking to those who are in this particular space, like the National Credit Regulator, which is mandated by the National Credit Act. We'll be unpacking that legislation as well. We'll be also speaking to the National Savings Institute. This particular show is aimed at giving more financial knowledge than it is at looking at the legal finances. This evening is fun-packed with an understanding on what finances are about, the therapeutic understanding of it, the psychology of the consumer. We're also going to be looking at those who are in the minimum wage bracket, as I understand that that is particularly one of the most challenging spaces to inhabit in this country. Primarily Law Focus listener, an understanding that which is being driven home by the show this evening is an understanding on what savings are about, an understanding on what the law prohibits and what the law allows. I think primarily it's an understanding that one needs to understand that before you borrow any money, borrow money from whoever who is certified by the National Credit Regulator. Secondly, it's understanding that one needs to live within their means. And I understand that it sounds like quite layman's knowledge, but at the end of the day, it's what governs the world, and it's what has become difficult for us to understand for many years. Law Focus listener, please stay tuned. But before we get into that, we're going to get into our legal hotspots for the evening.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week is Legal Hotspots.
Welcome back to Law Focus. For the Legal Hotspots, we're actually looking at three stories. The first story is about death tolls in the KZN taxi shooting, which have blew the country in storm. The second story is about bills. We're looking at two bills. The first bill that we're looking at is the Competition Law Bill. The second one we're looking at is the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill. And the third story is how the court has actually put an end to MUT schools. Quite a victory there for equal education. The first story is looking at how, sure. So there was a taxi shooting in KZN, whereby on Saturday nights near Tolenso in KwaZulu-Natal, and 12 people have actually been shot dead. So what happened is that 255 bullets were actually shot onto a taxi, which was carrying taxi drivers coming from a funeral for a taxi boss. And this taxi boss was among three people who were gunned down in Tembisa in Gauteng last week. So also on Monday, another taxi boss was shot and killed in Alexandra, Johannesburg. And nothing was taken from this guy. And the police say the motive for the killing is also totally unclear. Particularly, the National Commissioner, Kehla Sithole, has said that it's too early to have established a motive for the mass killing. It is understood that actually this is one of other deposits into death tolls in taxi shootings or taxi wars. And again, earlier in July in Alexandra, Renbeck, Midrand and Sandton Taxi Association, AMSTA, called for calm after its chairperson and his driver were gunned down with the chairperson killed. So clearly there has been a death toll in the country. These taxi wars have grown to that particular point, and it has become totally terrible for people's lives. I understand that this has induced quite a lot of fear, and we hope to see investigations into this matter and hopefully those who are committing these crimes brought to book. The second story is looking at a competition bill. So this bill is actually amending the Competition Act, and it's bringing teeth for the competition authorities to actually tackle cartels and monopolies. So Economic Development Minister Ibrahim Patel says that the Competition Amendment Bill will equip competition authorities with the tools to probe anti-competitive behavior by cartels and monopolies in the economy. So he briefed journalists in the Imbizo Center in Parliament, Cape Town, on Tuesday. He said that the bill, which was presented to Parliament on the same day, was drafted last year following concerns that anti-competitive behavior has increased, and its increase has actually made it difficult for smaller players to penetrate the economy, as is always the case. He said that while the main focus of the bill was to ensure economic transformation, it also seeks to address several big areas that affect competition. This includes prohibited practices like collusion and abuse of dominance by a firm, the structure of markets, which looks at economic concentration and its impact on small and black-owned businesses and mergers. Now, I understand that the transformation is quite an important principle in post-democratic society, and also how these anti-competitive behaviors have to really, really be combated and the law has to be tightened. He says that we believe that the amendments taken as a package will boost small, medium enterprises and economic inclusion, opening up the economy to fresh investment and evolution. We are hoping to see how this is going to play out in the event of this development. That bill has been before cabinet since 2017, and therefore we are hoping that by this time it will be passed with agreement between stakeholders. The second bill that we're looking at is provincial public hearings on the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill are complete, therefore meaning that the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill can go all the way to tabling. The public hearings on the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill are completed in all provinces by the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform. So thousands of people attended the public hearings to voice their opinion on the bill and to give their input on how the bill can work for them. Many are in support of reopening land claims, and a lot of people have actually requested the committee to ensure that land claims are submitted previously are settled first. Very important. Some are also proposing that permanent judges be appointed to preside over land claims, and then others have appealed to the committee to intervene and investigate allegations of fraud and corruption within the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. So the whip of the Rural Development and Land Reform Committee and an initiator of the private members bill, Phumzile Mguni, has said that they will not rest until the job is done, that they have been instructed by the Constitutional Court to conduct widespread public hearings into the Restitution of Land Rights Amendment Bill, and have done just that, going to all 9 provinces in the country. Therefore, this land bill is actually going to open up a lot of doors in that understanding. The committee has also made further deliberation on the inputs received and will meet all other relevant stakeholders such as academia, non-governmental organizations and other interested parties to further enhance this process. This will be one of probably the best bills that we've ever had with regard to restitution of land, and I'd like to see how it plays out should it go for tabling. The final story that we're looking at is how the court has actually ordered that MUT schools have to be removed as a constitutional requirement. Now, it will be remembered that Section 29, Subsection 1, Paragraph A, actually makes the right to education an unqualified right, meaning that all infrastructure and equipment that which is needed to ensure the right to education is being accessed by a student should be provided by to students. And if they are not provided to students, then that in and of itself is automatically a violation of that particular right. Now, because it's not a qualified right, meaning that it does not work subject to certain other conditions, it goes straight to the point. That right has to be given to students regardless of budget constraints. Now, that means that anyone can take the department to court in the event that they think the right is violated. And Equal Education has actually done so. And it has taken the matter to Bisho High Court, which has found that the government's norms and standards regulations for schools are unconstitutional. The court has actually ordered that schools substantially built from mud as well as asbestos, wood or metal have to be replaced with buildings that meet the national building regulations, right? This judgment in the Bisho High Court has been laid down on Thursdays, and therefore, following this judgment, all of these schools will have to be fixed. Now, Judge Bantu Bonke Tokota read in the judgment written by Acting Judge Norma Wabo Msizi in court on Thursday morning. The case was brought by Social Movement Equal Education against Minister of Education Angie Motshekga. It was heard in March. The court also awarded costs to Equal Education. And I understand that this order has actually ordered the department to actually renovate these schools subject to a certain time. But the court order actually said that where the regulations relating to minimum uniform norms and standards for public school infrastructure 2013 have referred to schools built entirely out of mud, wood, asbestos, or zinc, The wedding must be replaced with schools built entirely or substantially out of these materials. The court also found that the regulations compel government to provide water, power and sanitation in schools. Plans and reports on progress towards schools meeting norms and standards must also be made available to the public. Now, I understand that also, far more importantly, is how the court has interpreted this particular right, Section 29, Subsection 1, Paragraph A. It has interpreted the right to mean that anything, should it be a pencil, should it be a book, should it be anything that will enable a student to be in class, anything that will eliminate absenteeism of the student will fall within the ambits of Section 29, Subsection 1, Paragraph A. Now, in one of our interviews here on Law Focus, when we were doing the show on right to education, we have actually asked very strong questions to the director there of Equal Education, Ms. Karabo Oza. And one of the substantial questions we've asked is it an issue that in interpreting Section 29, Subsection 1, Paragraph A, the courts have actually looked more on the side of judicial review, saying that, well, these are the standards, these are the norms that you've had to follow, and because you didn't follow them, therefore go back to the drawing board. Now, isn't that a question of the rule of law? Now, in this particular case, Equal Education is taking it further than just the rule of law, further than just judicial review, and saying that, well, this in itself substantially is violating Section 29, Subsection 1, Paragraph A, and perhaps all other socioeconomic rights in the Constitution. Now, perhaps somebody can also interpret that particular right to basic education in conjunction with Section 28, which is the right to children, taking children as of paramountcy in connection with all other socioeconomic rights, or that those two rights can be interpreted as a window to all other rights, including civil and political rights, that which are provided in the Constitution itself. Now, understanding that with all attendant legislation like the Children's Act, the norms and standards that I've noted so far, one will understand why it's imperative to provide a child in basic education with all of this infrastructure and all of this assistance, including buses, scholar transport, including textbooks, making sure that every student has a book to study with at home in the event that they're sick or they're not, and then providing inclusion as well for disabled students, and also far more importantly, making sure that teenage students are protected and are well supported in their endeavor in class. Now, that is an understanding that we have, but this case is actually a victory in the sense that there's no longer going to be infrastructure that which is not to the standard of the country in any school. Therefore, meaning that every student is also entitled to have a corner in class, on a lighter note. But anyway, those are the legal hotspots, for the evening. You're still listening to Law Focus.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week. It's Legal Hotspots. Law Focus, handing you your rights.
Welcome back to Law Focus, and you're still sitting with me, Basil, and we're going to be talking to Mr. Maurice Maluleke, who's a supervisor of debt counseling at the National Credit Regulator. I mean, we've been discussing the NCR. We are discussing, we've been speaking to the Savings Institute, and we have been talking about how to save. We're looking at how to counsel those who commit into debt. But in general, we are talking money. It's July, and it's the month of money. On the line, I have Mr. Maurice Maluleke. Mr. Maluleke, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Shalinda, and good afternoon to the Voice of Bits listeners.
Thank you. As I said, you find us at the heart of discussing the National Credit Regulation. Can you please, in short, explain to us what the body actually does?
Okay. Thank you again. The role of the National Credit Regulator is to regulate the credit industry. We register the credit providers, debt counselors, payment screening agencies, credit bureaus, and alternative dispute resolution agents. And just to ensure that they all comply in terms of the Act and the regulations.
Okay. And so in terms of legislation, how is that first dealt with? So in the event that someone owes maybe a retail store,
okay,
What are the processes that have to be followed in order to give proper notice of that debt?
Okay, as you are aware that there's a lack of education in terms of financial management,
yes,
and most consumers are not aware of their rights when it comes to signing credit agreements, when they go under debt review, as an example. And what we try to do is, in the event that a consumer is not aware of what they are charged, or maybe they were not given a copy of a contract when they shall sign the agreement, they can usually contact us in the event that they can't get that copy of a contract from the credit provider, or maybe failure to disclose the total cost of credit, which includes interest, service fee, initiation fee and other costs that should be disclosed on the contract. So what the consumer have to do is to actually contact us in the event of a complaint, or contact us, or maybe go to our website and maybe send an email through to our complaints department. And now the challenge is only when the consumer either they've actually agreed verbally, and when what's on the contract is different from what was actually agreed upon. So those are some of the things that we actually deal with, most specifically with regards to the credit agreements. Like I've indicated, other entities that we regulate that are actually our registrants, any complaint against them, we actually assist in that regard.
Mm. And I mean, so with this information and educating, how far do you go? Do you go to the very heart of the poverty of the society?
Okay. Look, like I said, anything that has to do with where the consumer has actually signed the contract, I'll give you an example. Previously, before the Act was amended, those that could only register, the threshold was either 100 credit agreements or the loan book to the value of 500,000. Now, since that the threshold has been taken away, anybody who grants credit, whether it's shorthand or longhand, whether it's your neighbor, whether it's your uncle, anyone that grants credit, have to actually make sure that they register with us. So gone are the days where it will be a matter of the fact that I have less than 100 credit agreement and my loan book is less than 500,000. Therefore, I'm not obliged to register. We are aware of the fact that our people are being abused left and right by unscrupulous credit providers. It doesn't mean that when you are registered, you automatically comply. We still have to actually make sure that all our registrants, they comply in terms of the Act.
And that would mean that you'd have to enforce that constantly.
Yeah. So what we do is we either, if we receive complaints from consumers, and some of them are just proactive, some of them are reactive. You know, we can either decide to target a certain area where there's a common unethical practice or abuse of consumers in any form with regards to the credit agreement that they might have signed. So where we don't actually even make an announcement, we just actually rock in. I think you must have heard about some of the raids that we have done in certain areas where there's a prevalence of abuse, where there's a retention of cards, SASSA cards, IDs. In that fashion, we normally don't even make an announcement. But there are those that will literally do a normal compliance where we'll make an appointment with you to come and check us too. Whether you comply in terms of the Act, we look at your credit agreements, what you charge, and whether you disclose all the charges, and whether you give your consumers statements and contracts.
But then, Malek, let's contextualize the conversation now.
Sure.
In the event that somebody owes maybe a retail store and their debt is handed over to attorneys, and those attorneys call this this person who owes them, and this person explains that actually I've been unemployed for the past perhaps 2 or 3 months, and that's why I have not been able to pay that particular store, that particular retail store, and these particular attorneys keep on calling. What does the dirty do in that regard now?
Okay, I think we need to encourage, much as we talk about responsible lending, we need to talk about responsible borrowing. And it's the duty of a consumer to inform the credit provider that they are either retrenched or they've been dismissed. Obviously, with somebody who has been retrenched, there's a difference between the two, dismissal and retrenched. With retrenched, yes, you'll get to whatever that is due to you in terms of your pension, and same applies to that. But with retrenchment, in most cases, when some, a chunk or percentage of credit providers in the agreement will always be retrenchment cover, which you can then use to actually pay off your debt. But in the event that, let's say maybe you are retrenched, you have to notify your credit provider, anybody that you owes, they can either give you time to come with an agreement that you pay less than what you're supposed to pay. Or alternatively, they'll give you an opportunity, they'll freeze your account, give you an opportunity maybe to find another job. But in the event that you keep quiet, they do not know what's happening. But hence they will actually keep on calling you to actually want to make sure that you pay what's owed to them. So in that case, if you are retrenched, send them a letter to say, you know, I've been retrenched, I'm still looking for a job, please freeze my account so that interest doesn't actually increase.
Increase, yeah.
And, yeah. And in the event that where somebody is obviously dismissed for whatever reason, even if there's a cover, it will never, you won't be able to use that cover because, like I've given you the difference between the two. So it's important that as a consumer, make sure that when you are, anything, if it is due to your job, you lose your job, or for whatever reason, communicate with your credit provider so that they put that on record.
Mm.
And maybe you can actually, there are times whereby if it's hopeless that you can find a job and they don't have means to recover it, they can normally maybe write it off. Like, you can't demand a payment from an 80-year-old or 70-year-old where there's no hope that they will find a job.
Mm. And I mean, so what would your advice be to the majority of South Africans who fall into the category of the minimum wage, who go out and perhaps get buy clothes at buying power of plus minus?
Great. Look, you know what? I can't say to them, stay away from debts or maybe avoid taking credit, you know. At times, some people are actually under pressure and they are pressed to actually apply for credit, and of which they qualify for. But it's by all means, one need to try and live within their means and try to save as little as you possibly can. Look, I know to someone else it might sound very much impossible or maybe practically impossible, but what you can always encourage is only borrow when there's a need to actually do so. Do not borrow to go and buy a TV. If it's about paying your university fees, it's understandable. If it's about paying your rent, it's understandable. But always try to live within your means. Make sure that you do your own affordability because you can actually go and borrow money. And half the time, you'll find that a person has five accounts. And if you look at those accounts, collectively, they pay maybe 2,000 every month. And the question is, even if they didn't have those accounts, will they still pay 2,000 on a monthly basis? Will they still spend money on buying clothes on a monthly basis? Hence, I'm saying sometimes buying cash is better, or where possible, avoid incurring debts from time to time. Rather, have maybe one account to make sure that the one that you know that you can actually afford.
You know, for the comfortable, the statement that you just made can actually ring the greatest of bells. But for those in the minimum wage, it gets problematic, Mr.
Yeah.
Maralek.
No, I fully agree with you. As in my opening statement, I said, you know what, sometimes it's easier said than done, you know, because people face different challenges. Look, our sisters who are single parents, sometimes what they earn cannot actually satisfy their daily or monthly obligations. And hence I'm saying, as much as sometimes we encourage people to devise means of trying to make extra cash in a legal way, maybe selling something, you know, I know it's not something easy that a lot of people can actually be able to do. But like I said, in most cases, you'll find that the low income earners, a lot of them have more loans. And when you look at their income versus what they have to pay back. And remember, some of these unscrupulous credit providers, they don't do credit check to see if you can afford. They don't do affordability assessment. Hence, you find that some of them, they even never qualified for that loan. But if all credit providers were able to stick to the requirements or to the requirements in terms of the Act, some of these problems could be minimized. Like as I've given an example, we have your credit bureaus, we have the affordability assessment regulation tool that they can actually use to make sure that whatever they actually give out is something that the consumer can actually afford.
To go at the heart of the conversation, mm-hmm. What do you think can develop that kind of discipline that can assist someone to take debt responsibly so that they don't find themselves in that harsh waters?
You know, we have different categories of consumers, you know.
Mm.
Those that are educated and those that lack education. But it boils back to the fact that the impact of the situation impacts on both educated and uneducated, semi-educated. I still believe that we should do a lot in terms of educating consumers. There's no other remedy, you know. And look, our role is NCR. We do have an education department. It's unfortunate that we only have one office, but we try our best to make sure that we educate consumers on print media, audio. We try by all means to make sure that we give them advice in terms of, that's why we have different campaigns. Some will talk about how to borrow responsibly. Some will talk about savings. And it's up to the consumers to make sure that they listen. But like you said in the beginning, that sometimes the situation will actually press you to an extent that even if you know the consequences of what you do, you still want to actually, you still need credit. We all need credit. And especially with single parents, especially with parents with more than with more than what they can actually be able to afford. So my I still believe education is the way to go. And my wish was, even if we have to study from university level, you know, financial management skills, so that people get to understand that first thing that you need to do when you get into the employment space, employment world, is to try and save, and not to say you shouldn't buy on credit, but try to avoid having something, having everything on credit, your credit card, your car, your overdraft, and your home loans. Some of them you'll find that they have more than 5 credit cards. Mm. And forgetting that it's not their money, you know, and they will exhaust it. Come month end, you have to pay them. It stresses them to an extent that they end up not affording to pay them, and judgment is taken against them, and it messes up your credit profile.
Mm.
When you go, when you have to want to buy to a secured loan, for instance, a home loan, your name is actually blacklisted for only the reason that you failed to pay a loan which you didn't actually need maybe at that time. Hence, I'm saying we need to actually try to stick to what we can actually afford, you know. And it's unfortunate that when you look at our credit bureau monitor, the credit active consumers in South Africa, the numbers are actually increasing. So is the numbers of consumers with impaired credit record. So it's always chasing half of 24 million credit active consumers, and about 40% of that, 35 to 40% of that, they have impaired credit record. So what does that mean? It means in future you won't be able to buy on credit because of your status of your profile.
Mr. Maluleke, in closing, what would you say is the future for the National Credit Regulator? Is there anything that we should look forward to?
Look, all what I can emphasize to our consumers out there, I think some of the typical issues is this trending fraud online, et cetera, where we should refrain from giving our ID numbers to strangers or maybe online. And if you were to make an application for any credit, you know, make sure that you do your homework. Go make sure that the credit provider you borrowing from is registered and they are credible. And by all means, if you're not too sure, please contact us. And if you want to learn more about the National Credit Act, please go to our website. If you feel you have been taken for a ride by a credit provider in terms of your interest, in terms of what should have been done that you believe in, or maybe you have been paying your loan forever, please contact us, especially in cases where you don't even have a credit agreement and where they are refusing to give you an account statement. Contact us so that we can be able to actually investigate for you. Look, we are here to assist you, like I've indicated.
Mm.
We regulate the credit industry. That includes credit providers and the retailers. Anyone and anybody that actually grant credit, they are responsible in terms of making sure that they are compliant to the Act. And we are here to actually protect consumers. But we also encourage responsible borrowing. It shouldn't be a matter of knowing very well that you have the rights that you can exercise and engage in reckless borrowing because NCR or a regulatory body will be there to fight the battle for you. Let's try to actually take responsibility in anything that we do and try to save by all means.
Thank you very much, Tatana Maurice Maluleke,
who's
the supervisor of the Debt Counseling Department of the National Credit Regulator. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too. You too, sir. Thank you.
Law Focus. Point of information.
Welcome back to Law Focus. My name is Basil Shirinda. And you will be going live with me now. We're going to be discussing credit regulation in the country with a particular focus on the National Credit Act. Right on the line, we're going to be talking to the South African Institute on Savings. And we'll be speaking to Mr. Gerald Mandiambera. I hope I pronounced your surname correctly, sir. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, and good afternoon to all your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming through. You find us right at the heart of July, and we are moving into quite an interesting topic for our listeners. And we would like to understand quite further what the National Credit Regulation is about as a start.
Well, the National Credit Regulation is simply to try and govern how the access to money for the majority. As you are aware, the current household debt-to-income ratio in South Africa is well over 70%, and this has largely been driven by the fact that credit was not really monitored and people were given access sometimes when they couldn't afford to get access to it. So what the regulations will be doing is simply looking at how credit is given and making sure that affordability is checked, as well as also ensuring that the lenders are not taking advantage of citizens.
Yeah. And so what does the Savings Institute do, actually?
The South African Savings Institute is a non-profit entity which was created in 2001, and our primary aim is to promote savings and investment. We act as an advocate for consumers, and we liaise with government as well as the private sector around savings and investments. And also we do some research as well as consumer education. July Savings Month being our main, one of our campaigns, which we started 10 years ago. And this year we're in partnership with Absa Bank. And what we're simply doing is promoting the message of savings and investments. But what we want all your listeners to realize is that savings should be something that's happening every month and not just in July. We're not a government body, or nor are we a statutory body. We are a non-profit voluntary organization which simply operates to promote savings and investment and consumer education.
Okay. And so, like, in would you delineate for us who is far capable of saving in a spectrum in terms of how much they earn?
Well, most financial planning professionals recommend that you should be saving between 20 and 25% of all the income that you get. The simple reason being that, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. And also you need to grow and have a saving pool for when you eventually retire. So ultimately, that's how much financial planners recommend. This 20-25% can be split between your retirement fund, your savings account. Sometimes even your bond or your house can form part of your savings portfolio. But we do need to have a culture of savings where we realize that life happens, and when life happens, you need to have something to go into. The unfortunate thing about most South Africans is that even if someone is earning as much as 50,000 rand a month, most people earning that amount, if you ask them to give you 5,000 rand, they can't even absorb that financial shock. And it's even more worrying that people who've worked 10, 20 years cannot come up with an amount of even 10,000 or 20,000 rand in savings at any given point.
Yeah, that's very shocking. It's very shocking. So your campaigns, how far do your campaigns go? Do they go as low as the minimum wage category?
Well, saving is for everyone. There's no amount you need to have to save. Saving is relative to how much you're earning. So basically, if you earn more, you just save a percentage. So that's why we'd rather work in percentages, because 10 or 20% of any amount remains 10 or 20%, regardless of how much you earn. It's about willpower and the desire and the vision to see that you will need these savings in the future.
You know, Mr. Gerald, I'm actually inspired by your words. I'm just considering the difficulty that which most South Africans live in, especially those in the minimum wage. And I'm thinking about how difficult it could be for them to express themselves in the same tenor in which you've expressed this view.
I think, look, the bottom line is, even if you're saving as little as 10 rand, it's still a saving. I think most people seem to think that there's this thing that you earn too little to save. The bottom line is, if you were to lose your income, you'd be far worse off. Generally speaking, anyone who earns any sort of income has the capacity to save. And the main problem we have is that people don't save before they spend. They tend to spend and then see what they can save afterwards.
It's a
mindset and an attitude which you need to have. If you can save 10 rand from 100 rand, you'll be able to save 100 from 1,000. You'll be able to save 1,000 from 10,000. And you can even save 10,000 from 100,000. It's all relative to how much you're saving. And people seem to think that the more they earn, they'll be more able to save. In fact, the people who earn more are actually more in debt than those who earn less.
And what would you say can develop that kind of discipline? Because I think the fundamental string that I pick up from this conversation is that you either have the discipline or you don't. And if you do, then you can save whatever and you can find yourself at a better place. So what can develop that kind of discipline?
I think the main thing, if you want to start saving, is set yourself some goals. Part of the biggest frustration when you're saving is not knowing when you've achieved or not achieved a goal. So before you start saving, give yourself a goal. I want to save 1,000, 2,000 before this period is over. And then once you've achieved that goal, then you can understand that you actually can save. Most people who are engaged in open-ended saving, we ask, what are you saving for when? And they can't answer those questions. That's not really saving, because all that's going to frustrate you because you never seem to reach where you're supposed to go.
Well, I see. Let me bring it into context and perhaps personalize the conversation. I see it with myself. When I'm saving haphazardly, generally, which I try to do at times, I end up spending that money. But when I know that I want something that costs maybe 30K, and I think that I can raise the 30K in 6 months, for example, if I put in 6K per month. Now, 6,000 per month. But now what happens is that there are those months where something that you don't expect just pops up from nowhere. And now you have to put that money into something else. Now, how do you find the balance when those kind of situations happen?
I think what everyone must initially have is what they call an emergency fund. Okay. And an emergency fund is an amount of money which you have put aside for any emergencies or unexpected saving. This is separate to your goal-oriented saving, where, for example, you may be saving towards a specific goal. So that's what's important. Saving should not be one pool of money which is used at all times. No, have specific saving goals. One of them should be an emergency fund. It should probably be a separate account where you keep money for those particular rainy days or emergencies. Otherwise, you do end up doing what you're saying is, when you're saving for a specific goal, you end up using that money for an unexpected emergency.
Mr. Mwendambira, I don't know how practical all of this is.
It's very practical. All you need is to get started. Basically, if a child can have 5 piggy banks and know what's in each piggy bank and what's its purpose, an adult should be. The problem we have is that most of us, saving is not natural because we were not taught it. And yeah. You'll have to teach yourself as an adult. But the reality is, if you are not saving, you are far worse off. And there are many examples of people who have shown that they can save. For example, domestic workers typically have stock fails and other ways of saving. Thank you for bringing that example.
Can I please jump in? Thank you for bringing that example. Because I was about to tell you that we are an institutionalized society. Right, we have been brought into institution after institution ever since we were born. It's either it's crash, it's either it's church, it's either it's school, it's either it's work. There's always been an institution that assists us to achieve the goals that we want to achieve. And Stockfell is one of those institutions. I think that the argument that most people have in these kind of situations is saying that if I can find an insurance fund where I can put my money and just forget about it, then that's much better. Unlike when I have to personally save for all of these things.
Well, I think yes. Bottom line is saving depends on 3 things. Sacrifice, commitment, and discipline. And if you can't do all 3, you won't be able to save. Sacrifice comes from being able to afford whatever amount you're saving. So there's no point in saying, I'm going to save 6,000 rand a month, when in reality you know you can't. Start low. So make the sacrifice possible. The next thing is commitment. Commitment is about have someone to check your saving goals. So this might be other Stockfell members, or it might even be a financial planning professional, or indeed a friend who you check on who you're saving with. And the last one is discipline. Discipline, you can easily overcome it by automation. Simply set up a stop order or debit order. That money will be gone before you think about it, and you'll be able to save. So, for example, this month in savings month, our particular theme is to help get employers to help employees to save. And how do employers help employees to save? By encouraging you to save more towards your retirement, or even helping you by setting up a 13th check where automatically at the end of the year you receive a lump sum to fund the end of the year spending. So these things can be done. I think The thing about it is getting started. And the message is also that saving is not easy. It's a conscious decision because you're basically saying, I am putting money aside, which I could consume today. That is a decision you have to make, but you only can make it when you see what the future holds. The funny thing is people who've lost it all or have been in a situation where they lost their job, they have no problem saving. And all we're saying is you don't need to go through the fire to know that it is hot.
I understand that proposition. And in terms of investment opportunities, what kind of brackets can people access?
I think a lot of people ask about investment and savings opportunities. Everyone, for example, should have a tax-free savings account. If you don't have a tax-free savings account, you haven't even started saving, because that's an amount you can save annually of 33,000 rand tax-free, and it will grow and compound itself up to a maximum of 500,000 contributors in your lifetime. And before people start saying, we want special funds, we want extra things, let's start by going back to basics. Mm-hmm. Have a tax-free savings account. When you utilize the full amount, which is permissible tax-free, then you can start saying, okay, let's move on to the next level. I think a lot of us are trying to do matric before we've passed grade one.
The most interesting analogy that you've made there, that was Mr. Gerald Mandwambira from the South African Savings Institute. Thank you, Mr. Gerald.
Thank you very much.
Have a great evening.
Listening to Law Focus? Connect with VowFam 88.1 on Twitter and Facebook. Be your own lawyer. Law Focus.
The families of the 134 life as a Dimini victims actually have received compensation from the Gauteng provincial government. We are glad that the arbitral awards that which have been given by the former Deputy Chief Justice, Dikang Moseneke, have actually came to life, and we are seeing movement in that regard. The interesting thing is that the Gauteng Premier, David Makhura, has actually said that the Office of the Premier has actually paid out 159 million to all of the 134 claimants.
Law Focus. Talking active citizenship. Law Focus on VowFam 88.1, point of information.
Welcome back to Law Focus. You're still sitting with Basil, and we're still discussing debt collection this evening once again. Here on the line, we have Mr. Sias Kosana, who is a Masters of Arts candidate in drama therapy here at Wits University, and he'll be looking at the psychology behind our understanding on money, finances, and debt. And not to add more to his introduction, he's going to introduce himself far better with his perspective on the issue. Mr. Kosana, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Basil. How are you?
I'm great. You find us discussing quite a serious issue. I mean, most people find themselves in debt, and others find themselves as exploited by capital and so forth. But rather, the issue is how people handle their own money, and I think that has been the issue in our country particularly. And I understand that. I mean, why are many South Africans getting deeper into that, in your perspective, Mr. Sia?
Right. I think, first of all, Basil, coming from, as you said, a drama therapy perspective, for me, and a psychological framework, is that we exactly the meaning of money, and that money, in essence, is a medium for human beings in order to get something. So it's an exchange. It's a medium that used for exchanging one thing for another. So a lot of us misuse money, and we've come to understand that money is supposed to give us security, freedom, and control, and that stands for that.
Yeah.
So if one is insecure or lacks something, they intend to use money as a substitute for that. And that's the first initial problem that we have. So one then finds themselves buying things that they shouldn't buy in order to satisfy a need that is actually psychological or emotional.
Mm. I understand that your argument there is particularly that it's more in the psychological space, that rather
right. The
issue is how people relate with money, how they see themselves with their money. So there are people who are insecure, and therefore they use the medium of money.
Right.
So you're saying that when people are insecure, they actually look at money as a medium of expressing their insecurity. Is that your point, if I understand quite well?
And adding to that, not only to express their insecurities, but also to fulfill physical and psychological needs that they might have.
Yeah.
So, fine, someone might see a well-dressed individual, and they might want to look like that person, and they might misuse their money or their salary in order to look like Mr. X.
Yeah.
So my point is, rather than misusing your money, you need to look within and find out why are you comparing yourself with Mr. X. And for me, that is the basis of the misuse of money, that we don't know, or we lack the knowledge of what it is for, and that it is supposed to serve us. And what I've realized is that a lot of people serve money. So for me, that is the basis of the misuse of money, is that we don't know what it's for, and we don't understand it as a medium, and therefore we misuse it to satisfy emotional and psychological needs.
I mean, let's take it further. Should it be that people look at money to understand or interpret themselves? Could it be that the same reverse psychology could assist them in saving money? Is that the point that you're making?
In saving money?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, for instance, as we grow up, especially as African children, we're not taught about money. Even at school, we're not taught about money. However, if such teachings would take place, we would be more equipped in our adulthood to deal with money. So basically, one would have this education and would be made to realize the relationship that they have with money. So in order, going back to your point where this is now countering what I was saying, that we misuse money, we can then be taught on how to use money properly. Mm. So that might mean us saving money. That might mean us investing in money. So, absolutely, within the psychological terms, we can be taught to use money in a proper manner.
And so any interventions that you think can be used to assist people with this? I mean, because I understand that, or somebody could argue out there that we are instruments of institution, so therefore the only way we ever understand ourselves is if we are placed in an exercise that which assists us to get around these habits that we have. So, in your view, what kind of interventions would you advise one can take to assist themselves in this regard?
I think, as I said earlier on, it has to start at the grass level, where even at school we taught about how tax works.
Mm.
Where even at school we taught in terms of how to run businesses. Those things are important as algebra, I think. And I feel like our education system is lacking that.
Mm.
Lacking that education where we empower children and understanding the power of money.
Mm.
So that for me would be a vital intervention at the grass level rather than at university where it could be too late.
Mm. I mean, yeah, it sounds viable. But now what about someone who's perhaps understanding of all of what we just spoke about, but they're still in a space that which limits them, like maybe being a student that, as you would know, in an institution that which is totally unequal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the students are totally not on the same level, they come from different backgrounds, but particularly coming from a fourth quantile into an institution and that is previously white, and so that facing that kind of financial oppression, what would one do in that regard?
Absolutely. Okay, that's a good question. So what you're asking me is a more of a pragmatic solution.
Mm.
So, well, I think one's first stance would try and locate sponsorship. That would be meaning searching for sponsorship online, etc. Or even an extreme case would be maybe apply for a student loan at a bank. I know for myself, I've tried this at one of the banks in the university at Wits, where I got a student loan. So those are one of the values that one can take to solve their problems. But then, for me, that would be like a short-term solution. But to have a meaningful solution that could change one's life, one would have to take a look at their relationship of money and they refer and use money and why they use it the way they use money. And that for me would then require one psychological and emotional attachment to money.
That's very interesting. There's so much that one can unpack about that element of attitude and that element of psychology. Because I'm looking at people who do not who have not had money, and they get introduced to money perhaps at whatever age or stage in their life. And now, how would you combat their relationship with money?
So are you asking me that, folks?
Yeah, I'm posing it as an open question. I mean, right. Somebody who has never been exposed to money, perhaps has always been exposed to a range of, at the highest they ever went was like 5,000 rands. And all of a sudden in their working space or whatever, they get exposed to over 50K, 100K. Then now how do you combat that kind of a person's understanding of their relationship with money without them wasting it? I mean, how does that play out?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Because if you take a look at lottery winners, right?
Yeah.
So let's say before, I mean, we all know that there's a high percentage of them losing their money a couple of months after receiving it. And that says a lot, because if one was receiving 5,000 rand for the longest time, and within that 5,000 rand, one would spend 2,000 rand on clothes, 1,000 rand, maybe another 1,000 on entertainment, and would be left with 1,000 rand of savings. So the same will happen in a larger scale if one would receive 5 million rand, where one would use it maybe to buy a car, a million rand car, a million rand house. You don't need a million rand car or a house that costs a million. So for me, just being aware of how you use money, even when you have a small salary, because the way you use it when you have a small salary is how you will use it when you have a larger amount of money.
Mm.
And then, again, it goes back to what your relationship with money. So now I need to know that and how do I properly use that amount, whereby most of it I'm saving it or I'll be investing it. Because should I win the lotto, I'll use the 5,000 rand, or the same way I'll use the 5 million rand.
Mm.
So again, it goes back to how we relate and what we were taught about money.
Mm. I mean, yeah, Mr. Skosana, I'm actually quite thankful for your contribution. Anything that you think you want to add to what we've spoken about in closing?
Right. So I would like to say, again, going back to the grassroots, is that money is not a natural commodity. It was created by human beings, first of all. And it's an exchange medium. You exchange money for something. So if one is trying to achieve security, freedom, control, and their life, they should not use or misuse money as a vehicle to achieve those things. It starts within and a healthy relationship with yourself.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Skosana, for your contribution this evening. That was quite enlightening. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Law Focus.
Law Focus on Volvang 88.1 Point of Information.
Welcome back to Law Focus. You're still sitting with Basil Shirenda, and we have been discussing debt collection and debt counseling. We've been looking at finances. It is imperative that we have a clear understanding of how we should be dealt with by the law or by the company or corporate that which we owe. And we need to understand that primarily money is a vital element of our lives. And hence, this show was speaking to experts in the legal field, but also looking at experts from a psychological perspective. And also to your bestest of interest, somebody who can assist you to save. Now, the first person that we spoke to, or rather one of the people that we spoke to, was Mr. Maluleke from the National Credit Regulator. And he actually explained to us how the law actually deals with the issue at hand and how the corporate that you work for has to deal with you. And we went further to speak to Harold, who is from the Savings Institute of South Africa, and he explained his understanding of the psychology of money and how we should understand saving. Lastly, we spoke to Mr. Skosana, who is in drama therapy and is looking at the psychology behind money and our understanding of how we tend to use money to define and redefine ourselves. Now, with that perspective, one needs to understand that primarily, the understanding is that when you owe someone, First, you must first borrow money or take debt from whoever who is registered with the National Credit Regulator, as far as it's mandated by the National Credit Act. That is the first port of call. The second port of call is that in the event that you are no longer employed and perhaps maybe you owe a retail company that which you bought clothes from, or you bought a wall unit or whatever of that nature, and then that company has to first send you a couple of letters that which are stamped by the magistrate, and then you have to answer their calls, and that's when you have to let them know that I'm no longer employed, and that means that you were going to have to keep them in the loop in the event that you get re-employed. Now, the trick about this whole scenario is that people tend to want to be liars, but secondly, tend to defraud. And that's why it's so important that people get affidavits to try and explain that, oh, I am no longer employed anymore, and this is how I want to go about it. But now further, what is far more important is your well-being. And the Savings Institute actually states that, one, people need to live within their means. Secondly, people need to save. Now, Mr. Herald there looks at 25%, says that you must save 25% of whatever that you're making. Doesn't have to be a lot, as long as it's something. And Mr. Herald actually argues that it is very important for people to understand that they don't have to live above their means to try and prove a point. In actual fact, they should live within their means and be honest about how much you are making and how much you can afford to spend. And then we spoke to Mrs. Kosana, who actually says that, well, it's very imperative that one does not try to define themselves by looking at person X, and says that even if it doesn't matter how much I earn, but I want to be like person X, so that they can be able to validate themselves. Because by doing so, then you end up spending money that you don't have, and at the end of the day, you are left with nothing. And then you have a problem. But now, we went further into it, and we looked at how difficult it may be to implement that philosophy, one, in an unequal institution that which brings you closer to people of different classes. Secondly, how to do that within the minimum wage gap, because to start with, you have nothing. And I think we also touched on that with Mr. Maluleke when we spoke about how when he said that go and borrow money for important things like your tuition and not to buy accessories. And I said, but the challenge is that people need these accessories. People need to watch TV. People need all of these things. Or maybe even though they may be classified as wants or desires, but people still need to live with these things. And so now how is one able to say, okay, I can forgo this, but I can go for that? And now, what does that mean for people who live in the minimum wage space again? Because then that means that they don't have some of the leisure that which other people may have, and that is those who are comfortable and who are rich. And now, from that perspective, one gets to understand why there's a necessity for us to not only delineate where we are as people, but what we expect to be achieving from the money that we have. But at the same time, is understanding that the reality of those who have nothing is far beyond just saving, having money and blah blah blah, but it's purely survival. And I understand, and it is my understanding to say that if one can survive to build a future, then they're fortunate to do so, and they should do so. But if one cannot, it is important not to live above your means, because the next thing that you do is drown yourself, and you don't have the best that you should be having in the first place. And the next thing, that the people that you are pleasing are the very people that you go back and you seek help from. Low Focus listener, we have had a great show for this evening. And from our producer, Ms. Bulali Diakobu, who made this entire show possible, we say thank you. From our technical production, Mr. Kutwano Gwinch Serame, from me, remember that if it's not legal, then it's unlawful. If it's unlawful, then it's wrong. From me, Basil Shirinda, it's law and it's serious. Have a great evening.
Listening to Law Focus? Connect with VowFam 88.1 on Twitter and Facebook. Be your own lawyer. Law Focus Podcast.